This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 188, The Law Firm of T'Pol and T'Pol. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Norm Lau. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including The Art of the Ships of the Line, the autobiography of James T. Kirk, and more books, the Star Trek Beyond Dubai set, and we debate the results of the StarTrek.com Best Couple poll. Then in the feature, we're joined by Will Wynn and Mike Morrison to discuss the Enterprise episode E Squared. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Norm. It's great to have you back here with me on the show. It's been quite a while since you co-hosted. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask you, what do you think about my new ready room here aboard the USS Tokyo?
I think you actually run a really tight ship. I can see, at least from my observational viewpoint, that there is zero dust that's going on in your ready room. I appreciate that.
You cannot see very well then, Norm. There is way too much dust around here, actually. It builds up very quickly. But never. I'm really excited here to be on my new ship, the USS Tokyo. I got a nice surprise last week. Our friend James Swallow, the wonderful author who writes many of the Star Trek novels, his new Titan novel, Sight Unseen, was released on September 29th. And he gave me a cameo in the book, I Am the Captain of the USS Tokyo, which would have been a contemporary of the 1701D, in fact, and mentions me directly by name, Captain Christopher Jones, USS Tokyo. So thank you, James, so much for that cameo.
We totally have to petition Eagle Moss now to make a USS Tokyo. That would be amazing. Would it be Akira class?
That would make sense for the USS Tokyo, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah, it was great. You know, James gave Matthew a cameo in the past where there was an Andorian freighter an Andorian ship named the Matt Russ.
Oh.
And because James, he's a longtime listener of Literary Treks. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he's thrown us into the books here. So that was really cool. Riker the Titan, they're on their way to rendezvous with my ship.
I think that's super cool. I mean, I think it's probably one of the coolest things in fandom to be able to be immortalized inside your fandom in some way, right?
Right. Yeah. It's sure. Cool. Mm-hmm. Very, very cool. So how about you? One thing that it's not on our list to talk about, but I just want to hear a little bit about. Mm-hmm. I noticed that you got like a massive Axanar swag package the other day, and you've got like all those things that everyone is coveting. How is all that stuff you had there in that picture?
Oh, it's super nice. As a matter of fact, I think that it was a pretty popular post on the Axanar fan group page on Facebook, and I'm pretty sure that I had to go in and make sure that I stripped away any single iota of where my identity is or my whereabouts, because I think some people are coming for my coming for my goods. Now, you know, I've been a supporter of that project for quite a long time, and I remember, I mean, this is February of 2014, I think, is when this all started. Okay. And I believe that Kickstarter closed around March. This is for Prelude to Axanar.
For Prelude, yeah.
Yeah, the 22-minute, yeah. And this is where all of these goods are coming from or being based on. So there, I mean, Alex Bornstein's CD, amazing, amazing soundtrack. He's an amazing composer, and he sets a really great tone for the 22-minute piece. And there's
he studied with Bear McCreary,
right. So you have that
good kind pedigree of, there.
Absolutely. I mean that kind of really nice modernistic science fiction flavor. I mean, Bear McCreary, we know him from, like, I know he's working in Defiance, Battlestar Galactica. Yeah. Was he on Battlestar Galactica?
Yeah, that's where a lot of people know him from, is Battlestar Galactica.
So yeah, right. He's very Alex is very pedigreed, and then you have probably the coolest thing about that is Robert Meyer Burnett's hand on all of the documentary and special edition footage that you get on there. So, word to the wise, I know a lot of people are like, what do I need a Blu-ray or a DVD for? Because that's where you get this content. And I'll make sure that when I review it in more in depth, I'll be posting those notes to the Babel conference as well.
Yeah, it's awesome, awesome stuff. And I'm glad they're getting that out there. So everyone go check out Axanar if you haven't already.
And then some people ask me, is it still too late to get that? And I'm like, no, it's not. If you go to the Axanar website and click on the donations page, you can still donate to some of these premium items and help support the project.
They have a donor store where you can go back and you can pick up past items. So really cool stuff there.
Right.
All right. Well, we have a few things to talk about in the news segment here, and then we're going to be joined by your cohort from Warp 5, Will Wynn, as well as Mike Morrison to talk about E2, which is a really fun episode. Mm-hmm. Before we do that, though, we just talked about books because I mentioned that James put me in the latest Titan novel. We've been seeing a lot of books coming out recently, and some of these are new that we're going to talk about, and some of them maybe aren't necessarily, but they've caught our eye in the bookstores, and they make us think about what CBS and others are doing with the franchise itself as we head towards the 50th anniversary with books. Now, you were telling me about one in particular that caught your eye in the bookstore the other day.
When I was in Barnes & Noble's the other day, I was looking through the science fiction section, and the first thing that grabbed me was there was actually something new in the Star Trek section that wasn't a paperback novel. And because it actually had the official 50th anniversary bug or icon emblazoned on the cover, that's what really got my attention first. And it was the Ships of the Line portfolio, 24 professionally printed and ready to be framed pieces of work by Doug Drexler and by people that have been putting out artwork for the Ships of the Line calendars. And it was really premium, gorgeous packaging, and very well protected, so you know that the contents inside weren't damaged, so that you can go out and actually frame these pieces of work. So I thought that was really nicely presented.
That is really cool. How large are those? Are they like legal? What would it be for the states? Like 11 by 17?
That's what I was thinking. Smaller? I think it might be maybe 13 by 19.
13 by 19? Because that's a pretty big book there then.
It was a thick envelope, and it was a thick cardboard stock. And I think they did a really good job there shelving that and making that prominent when people were walking by, because as you know, when you walk by a bookshelf, it's pretty much a sea of all types of designs. But that in particular, the 50th anniversary bug really did stick out. And I thought that for our listeners out there, that is worth paying attention to when you're walking through the bookstores and trying to find anything Star Trek related amidst the sea of Star Wars merchandising that's going on
right now. Well, that's also cool that they think to do that, and also that they package it without folding them in any way.
Yes.
That you can actually frame those. That's really, really nice. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to look for that when I am in Kinokuniya, which is the really big bookstore in Shinjuku that has one entire floor of English books. I might be able to find that there. I was in there a few days ago, in fact, and I walked by and saw a book, which is not new, but I had not seen it in person before, and that was the Fun with Kirk and Spock children's book.
Do you remember an example from that book? I mean, okay, so it's targeted at ages what?
Oh, I'd have to go look to know for sure, but just looking at the pictures, I would say it's probably from like ages like 4 to 9, 4 to 12, something in that range.
And it's done in a very kind of crayon-y kind of ruled paper kind of style, right? Notebook
it's
paper.
Playful illustrations that are more like something you might have seen back in the 60s, maybe.
Yeah.
That kind of art style. And they've got things like Kirk and Spock playing a joke on Khan when he's in the chamber still on the Botany Bay, you know, like they're going to let the air out or something like that.
Such a sweet and innocent interpretation of the actual events that happened.
Yeah, it's fine. It's you're going around with Kirk and Spock and you're having fun. You're kind of getting into mischief.
Well, there was like, that, like that. There's a Star Wars book there. It's like Scott, you know, it was the Darth Vader and Son.
Yeah,
very
I've seen
cute,
that one. Yeah.
You know, very cute. Yeah. But again, it's...
In fact, I think I've seen that one in Japanese probably. See, that's the thing though. That the reason I like that particular book, or when they did the visual encyclopedias or something in recent years, is that they actually make an effort to make some kind of Star Trek book that's aimed at children, because Star Wars does that really well. Mm-hmm. And that brings new people into the fandom. But Star Trek doesn't do that so well. And the fan base, we keep getting older and older and older. And how do we introduce this to a new generation of fans beyond the Abrams films?
Beyond?
You know, beyond?
Was that appropriate when you say that, beyond? I'm just kind of like...
It's starting to become that way. It's bleeding over. And, you know, I ask for directions. And I say, so let me get this straight. I'm supposed to go beyond the post office... And then take a ride, and people are just looking at me like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Oh, my God. Oh, that's so funny. That is so funny. I got to compose myself so I can get through the rest of the show, because that's fantastic.
So, but anyway, I like these children's books because they help people get in.
I think, you know, one of the things that I think Star Trek does struggle with here and there, and Matthew Rushing and I were talking about this. Everyone knows Matthew Rushing's name here on the Ready Room. And it was the entry point level of which you can access your fandom. And on one of his posts for the 602 for one of his Star Wars feeds, we're talking about how Star Wars is brilliant about where people can just start.
Yeah.
You know, right. And maybe that's something that we should tackle like later on in one of the shows, is how do you start? Where is a good point where you don't feel overwhelmed when you're looking at just basically staring down the barrel of the original series, 7-9 episodes, plus the movies, plus the animated series, plus Next Generation? I mean, it's kind of like mission log, looking at like, oh, we have how many episodes to cover still? But where do you jump in?
Yeah. Well, they kind of addressed that a little bit last year, or maybe not last year, maybe it was a couple of years ago, but with the Star Trek Origins Blu-ray, where they picked about, I've got it on the shelf over there, I think it's 5 episodes from the original series, which were your entry points. And it was really designed for people who had seen 2009 and Into Darkness.
Right.
How do those people then get into Star Trek? And so they picked these specific episodes that would provide you with the key information that you could relate to after having watched the movies. And then Rod recorded a new foreword, I believe, for that as well.
Okay.
Well, the other book that we want to talk about a little bit here is the autobiography of James T. Kirk. I have it. It's on my iPad. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I know that Matthew and Dan just did it on Literary Treks, and I believe that David Goodman, who wrote the book, is on there with them as well.
Okay.
And they do an interview, because that's what we always do on Literary Treks, is have the authors on when these books come out. Just in terms of a concept, I mean, what do you think about that within the context of what we're talking about here?
Well, I actually picked that up also just to peruse it, and I found it interesting that it did not have the official 50th anniversary marketing to it, which I thought it would be, you know, hand in hand. You know, you have the autobiography of what I believe the fandom feels is the most famous captain in Star Trek. Not the most beloved, I'm not saying, but the most famous in terms
of the
marketing.
And
so there was nothing on there about that. I also found it very interesting that there is a section, and I'm not sure if it's in your iTunes download, but there is a section of color photography in the middle of the book, as most of the books like this have. And all of the imagery is William Shatner as Captain Kirk of that era, and not an interpretation at all of Christopher Pine. But I mean, I understand why, but it still kind of leans towards that William Shatner is Kirk.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes.
I still think with the Star Trek fan base that that's the angle that you have to take when you're marketing something like this. I personally don't feel like there are enough people out there who would buy something that took the angle that Pine is Kirk.
But that's where
Shatner is Kirk.
I mean, that's kind of like where this whole, where do you draw the line between servicing fans that have already poured a substantial amount of their own personal income into collecting all things Star Trek? I mean, what would this really service them in terms of, oh, another Captain Kirk collectible featuring William Shatner's Captain Kirk versus the new audiences that they're trying to capture with Beyond and starting to market Chris Pine's interpretation of Captain Kirk on that as merchandise.
I think there could be a couple of things at play as well. I still think this is the last movie of the Abramsverse experiment, personally, in this universe. That's how I feel right now. The other big thing may have to do with licensing, because, as you know, for the Abramsverse, Bad Robot is all involved in that. And there really isn't a crossover. And I think there are, in fact, rules about, you know, you cannot use imagery or characters from those two films in the way that you use the others. It's separate licensing. Now, you see, like, Elephant Mouse did the Star Trek Rivals game, which has now been retired, but that was actually the Abramsverse. All those cards were the Abramsverse. And when I had them on the shows and talked about the development of that game, I asked them, will you ever do a Prime Universe one? Because that's what I felt there was a bigger market for. And they said at the time that, you know, they would love to, but right now the license was for the Abramsverse characters and all. So it could be a case where they can't easily mix Shatner and Pine together in that section of that book because of the licensing.
But why not just have a completely separate, you know, starting point for, here's the autobiography of Kirk. I mean, a lot of the fans that went to go see 2009 know of his history of starting thusly, you know, you know, with his birth after the attack of the Narada on the Kelvin. So there's that. And I'm not saying that this is how you should interpret it, and this is how you should interpret the other version of Kirk, but it just, it seems to me that there needs to be a consolidated effort of marketing, because, again, I'm throwing Star Wars out there because they do it better than most. There is this through line that they know how to appease their fans and what they need to disseminate to them in terms of lore and in terms of structure of marketing.
It's really, really tough. I mean, you and I both work in marketing, communications, design, having to do this for products. And also, we know how tough it is to craft something like that that works for everyone. And when you're dealing with Star Trek, I think it's extremely difficult. Leading into the 50th anniversary, though, because there's going to be an Abramsverse film released during that year, it would make sense to do some consolidation like you're talking about. So we'll see if they do it with some other products. I don't know. As for why does this book not have the 50th anniversary bug on it, just speculation on my part, it could be that because they're just rolling that out, it could be that this was designed and in the production process beforehand and no one came in and put that on at the last minute.
Bullet stickers can go out so quickly, especially with something like that. It's already
Stickers. Having it integrated into the actual printing.
Just one of those things. You know, it's kind of like when they started releasing or re-releasing Star Trek 2, 3, and 4 repackaged with that bullet sticker saying that the adventures of Kirk and Spock, trying to basically leverage what was going on with the popularity of 2009 at the time.
I think they were doing it more after 2009, right? So much after Into Darkness. All right. Well, those are some books that we've seen anyway that are really interesting and are helping move us towards the 50th. And I'm curious to see what else they're going to do as we get closer. Let's move on to the next thing here. Now, this is a poll from StarTrek.com, which we often talk about here on the Ready Room. This one especially caught my eye when it first came out. I did vote in this poll along with 7,000 fans who voted in this poll, which is actually kind of a small number compared to some of their polls because they often have like 20, 25,000 votes. This one's only 7,000, but it asked, who is Star Trek's best couple? And so it does tie in to what we're going to talk about in the feature today, because we're going to talk about Trip and T'Pol. As far as legitimate options go, because they give you on StarTrek.com the options that you can vote for and you can't do a write-in. So the options were, of course, Riker and Troy, and Picard and Crusher, B'Elanna and Tom, Worf and Jadzia, T'Pol and Trip, and then also Worf and Troy. Now, I'm going to have you reveal the results here, Norm. How many people voted for Worf and Troy?
A whopping 3%.
Now, do you think those were legitimate votes or were those like cynically cast votes?
You know, I was looking at this, and as much as I haven't watched a lot of Deep Space Nine, I'm surprised that this was actually mentioned before Kira and Odo.
So you're saying that you think the Kira-Odo pairing is equally as odd as Worf-Troy pairing?
I think it actually should have been mentioned instead of Worf and Troy.
As a more legitimate option.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree with you on that. Yeah, that's what I'm getting at.
I'm looking at this. I'm like, okay, it's fine. But I actually think people probably would have responded well to Kira and Odo. I mean, I thought that was fantastic. Oh,
yeah. Kira and Odo is a great relationship. And most of these others are legitimate relationships. And I say most because technically Picard and Crusher were not a couple. I know in the minds of fans, fans want them to be a couple. And I think that they themselves wanted to be a couple. But as far as the writing goes, Picard and Crusher were not a couple. And so I don't think that they should have been an option on this poll.
I mean, if for anything, there were only a handful of episodes. And yes, The Naked Now probably brought that to the forefront because they were, it's basically like two people that really like each other. And then you have a few drinks and that kind of like reduces your inhibitions and it brings those feelings to the forefront. Yes, he was dealing with the loss of Jack. Yes, she was too. But there really wasn't that type of interplay anymore after the first season. I mean,
right.
You know, in total, not the way that a lot of these other relationships were structured.
Now, I guess you could say that because in All Good Things in the future time frame, they had married and divorced, you could say they're a couple. But anyway, I think, yeah. Like you're saying, Kira and Odo should be on here.
Most definitely. Yeah.
Perhaps instead of this. But Worf and Troy is the one where I feel like 3% of the people maybe just cast a cynical vote for Worf and Troy because I have never, ever met any Star Trek fan who actually liked Worf and Troy as a couple.
And I think it was just one of those, what are we going to do this season just to add a little bit more spice to this drama? Right.
But it wasn't even the season. It was at the end of the series. It was like, we've only got a couple of episodes left. Why don't we make Worf and Troy a couple?
It was, right? Let's just swing for that fence. You know, why not? But I agree. It's a weird pairing for me.
So let's run through, let's go in reverse order. Tell us what the results are.
So tied at 12%, we have T'Pol and Trip from Enterprise. And we have what we just discussed, like briefly just a seconds ago, we have Picard and Crusher from The Next Generation. And for me, I think T'Pol and Tripp's relationship is actually very well written and very well orchestrated throughout the course of the series because you have really two diametrically opposed personalities. I mean, not just in personalities, but also in species. And they came together in the brilliant Terra Prime and Demons episode to show what could have happened in an actual relationship that would have produced the first Vulcan hybrid offspring.
Yeah. I think their relationship is very real as well in the way it's written, in the way that they come together. There are circumstances that lead them to help one another, and they build a genuine relationship in that way. So I think T'Pol and Trip is a very good one. I think that like everything with Enterprise, this relationship and other things from Enterprise, when they are options and polls, they tend to come out at the bottom, fourth or fifth, because not enough people have seen Enterprise.
No, I agree. Sure.
I think that's the reason.
Yeah.
And Picard and Crusher probably came in here towards the bottom as well, because like we said, most people probably don't actually see them as a couple. And those who do want to see them as a couple were simply frustrated by the fact that they never actually became a couple.
I think it's a sentimental odds-on favorite. I think that, you know, you're right. It's like, yeah, we liked the interaction that we got. And yes, we had All Good Things kind of reference and allude to the relationship that they had because they were basically arguing like an old married couple who weren't married. And yeah, sure. I mean,
I also think that 9% of the people who voted for Picard and Crusher are those who believe that Picard is Wesley's dad.
What? Mind blown.
Okay, so let's move on. We have three more couples to go here.
Okay, so at 20%, we have B'Elanna and Tom Paris. And I wish that I could speak more specifically about this, but I don't really know Voyager all that well. I do know one thing. I do know that this is the relationship that a lot of people actually really do enjoy talking about, because I guess there is, it was well written, and these are two of the more popular, if not the most popular, perhaps aside from Janeway, on Voyager. I mean, I'm sure Shara could probably throw in, you know, her, well, you know, her thoughts, yeah, on this.
I think the Doctor is probably the most popular along with Janeway. But Tom Paris is very popular. And for me anyway, he's probably my favorite character. The Doctor is probably my favorite character from Voyager. Tom's probably my second favorite. And Tom's probably my favorite in terms of a character arc, the way that he develops from start to finish.
From Nick Locarno to Tom Paris?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Right. And at one of these days, Tom's dad is going to take that picture of Nick Locarno off of his desk in his office and put a picture of his actual son up there. So it's the way also that Robbie McNeil plays the character. Mm-hmm. I think it was a wonderful character growth. But I also really like this relationship, and I like it because you have Hothead B'Elanna at the beginning, and you have Flyboy Tom, who, you know, is always breaking the rules and all. And they both mature over the course of the series and their journey, and they come together, and they both become better people, I think, as a result of the relationship that they have with one another. B'Elanna becomes a much more caring and calmer person. Tom also becomes a much more mature and loving person, and I think becomes a good husband and a good father there at the end as well. And I think it's a really good relationship and very deserving to get 20% of the vote.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
The next one is a fan favorite, and why not? This is Riker and Troy.
And yeah.
At 26%.
Now, I think, and I'm going to go ahead here and reveal myself who's first, because we need to talk about these together. Mm-hmm. Edging this with 1% of the vote, with 27%, Worf and Jadzia Dax.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I went ahead and said that because I think that most people would expect Riker and Troy to win this poll, because they are certainly the more famous couple within Star Trek compared to Worf and Jadzia. How do you feel about this photo finish here? Would you have put Worf and Jadzia first? Would you have put Riker and Troy first, or someone else?
You know, it's interesting, because I think the reason why that there is just this slight margin of difference is because of what happened between Worf and Jadzia. And what I mean is that Jadzia's death at the hands of Gul Dukat. So that is that a spoiler alert now?
Well, I'm not sure we've established how many decades need to pass before it's okay to reveal something.
sorry, people, but okay. So let me rephrase that. There was a very dramatic episode that really put Worf's and Jadzia's relationship at probably the most extreme risk. And I think that's probably...
And that would be the episode where Dukat kills Jadzia, right?
Spoiler alert. But yeah, and you know, because they built this whole time where, you know, this is actually part of Deep Space Nine. I do remember that Jadzia was, she was putting herself hand over foot in terms of trying to make sure that Worf's Klingon needs were being met. She met with Martok's wife so that she made sure that the ceremonies were correct. She basically did everything so that she and Worf would be able to have this future together. And once that happened, tragedy struck.
Yeah.
Riker and Troy obviously don't have that. They have a great relationship that was very well matured over time, over the course of the seven seasons of Next Generation. And yes, you had that little bit of drama between Worf and Riker in All Good Things. And you can allude to that future, because we're not exactly sure if that future happened. But that's probably the breaking point between these two, and the big tiebreaker, that 1%, is that Worf never had the opportunity to be happy with all of the effort they put into trying to make that relationship work. And Riker and Troy actually were able to be happy in their relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me too, like Riker and Troy, it's such a, you know, we were a couple and we decided to break up and now we have to work together. And yeah, we kind of have feelings for each other because we have the Sims-Hottie connection. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to be a couple. We're going to do our own thing. And maybe we're a couple. No, we're not. And then they finally get married. But comparing that to Worf and Jadzia, Jadzia helped Worf become, like I said with Tom and B'Elanna, Jadzia helped Worf become a better man and helped Worf mature his views on being a Klingon, on his role in Starfleet, just where his life is going. And Worf and Jadzia were a real couple where you have two very, very strong personalities and two very strong people together. And so it was a bumpy relationship, mm-hmm. but it was also a very loving relationship. And then tragedy did strike, as you say. And if I am thinking by defining best couple, how does the couple work together as one? You know, when you're a couple, when you're with someone for so many years, you really do become like one. And I think Worf and Jadzia had that. I think Tom and B'Elanna had that. I don't think that Riker and Troy really had that in what we saw on screen over the course of the series. I think maybe they ultimately have that after they get married and we move beyond Nemesis, but we don't see that, right? We
right,
don't see right. that. So for me, if I were rating these, I would go Worf and Jadzia first, I think. Second, probably B'Elanna and Tom. I'd probably put Kira and Odo in here.
Mm-hmm.
And then T'Pol and Trip.
I mean, you know, going to your point where you said, how does the relationship affect both people and who learns from both and who influences both? I think that Odo learned pretty much as he could learn about being a human, about mm-hmm. understand, well, not being a human, but being able to understand what it means to connect.
Yeah.
Through Kira.
And to connect with someone who you can't just simply merge with in the Great Link, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Someone and who you can't, you have to read them, like you cannot actually absorb their thoughts, yeah.
Right, and I loved the whole attempt with him and Vic Fontaine trying to create like the
so
perfect
awesome.
Night. I mean, that's the stuff that's memorable. I don't remember a time that Riker and Troy did that, you know, like have that type of an event. Or at least Riker going, you know, I need to get Troy back. I think I'm going to, like, you know, set something up really nice in the holodeck or something. I don't know, but
maybe, yeah, no, not really setting up something like that. But, you know, I think he got a little jealous when Tom Riker was around.
But yeah, but he's kind of looking at, like, the cooler version of his own self. Like, what happened to me?
You right. <know?
laughs> So, yeah, I definitely would throw Kira Noto up there further than not even being on the list at all.
It could be interesting to see how Riker and Troy would have been written if they were on a show like DS9 with that type of storytelling. Mm-hmm. What would they have done with those two characters? That could be interesting.
Well, the cool thing about Worf and Jadzia is that Jadzia's experience with all of her different symbionts, those actually became more of a counselor to Worf than any counselor that he ever had, probably even more than Deanna. And it was understanding that, you know?
Yeah.
It was understanding that and having all that those centuries of experience to be able to actually understand what to do with Worf.
Well,
or how to deal with
when
Worf.
It comes to Worf, Martok was a way better counselor than Troy ever was. So
true.
Yeah. All right. Well, those are the results. So let us know what you think. Who was the best couple? Great place to do this is in the Babel Conference on Facebook. Type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and that'll take you in. If you're not already in there, it's a closed group. Click join, we'll let you in. But you can talk to us and all the other listeners there as well. So this is a really good topic for discussion there. But if you're not on Facebook, you know, you can tweet us at Trek.fm or go to trek.fm/contact. Use the form there. Send to a show, send to the ready room. And let us know what you think about this or the books or anything else we're going to talk about today. We'd love to hear from you. Those are many ways for you to contact us. All right, let's quickly talk about one last thing here, Norm, mm-hmm. as we're passing half an hour in news. But I do want to touch on this one little bit of news from Star Trek Beyond.
Beyond.
They have left Canada. They've gone to the other side of the world. They've gone to Dubai. They're building these sets at the foot of Central Park Towers in Dubai. And TrekCore has a bunch of photos of the set. And it looks like it's something on ground level. They've got green screens so they can do set extensions. And I'm curious what you think about them, because the first thing that popped in my mind when I saw the overhead view is that it reminded me of Denova from Operation Annihilate.
Yeah, no, that's actually an interesting call. It's really tough, though, speculating about these snippets of information that you get, you know, and seeing things out of context and not seeing them polished and finished in post. It's really interesting when you're looking at these images, how the scope of these pieces.
It is big, right?
Yeah, and there's obviously in the top image, there's a lot of either overgrowth or damage or rust or something that's happening with the exterior. So it looks like we're dealing with something that has either been discovered or something that's recently been damaged. It's really hard to say, but it's quite large in structure in terms of the scale when you're comparing the lip of that overpass or overstructure to all the trees and all the foliage and stuff like that. It adds a nice sense of scale. But I think it's also really cool that they're doing this in Dubai, because it offers them a little bit of secrecy and probably incredible tax reduction benefits.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, the thing that we're seeing here, and everyone, you can go to TrekCore. We'll put a link in the show notes, but you can go to TrekCore.com and you'll see the story up there and you can see the photos. It looks like it could be the back of a spaceship, like a crashed spaceship, or it could be part of a building. And I noticed that how they have the green screens running along the sides of it, they come up about to the height of where this structure that they've built ends. So it seems like it's designed so that they can do set extension of the structure, maybe, as opposed to doing set extension of, you know, like trees or some other type of thing here. And then above that, I think they could go in from the top of the green screens up into the sky and do whatever they want to do there in terms of doing a new background of the structure. So it feels like maybe this is a planet, a city or something where they're going to be heading into some sort of building, but it does look very, very old, right? It's like not a nice, shiny new thing. Maybe this is an abandoned city. I don't know.
Now, it's great for speculation. And the more I look at the primary piece of set design, it almost looks like there's some landing gear that's coming down. And it could be, again, it could have been a damaged ship. It could have been damaged as it's coming through hot through the atmosphere. It looks like there's some scoring that's going on in the front of the ship, if this is a ship, in fact.
Yeah, and which we don't know.
Right, so
there is another shot where there is what TrekCore describes as blue discoloration over about half of the surface here. And they say they don't believe that it's a shadow and they think maybe it's something else. I'm pretty sure it's just a shadow, because there is a, in the top photo, you could look at that one and think it's just shading, but there's another photo where, you know, I work in a huge city in Tokyo, so I'm very familiar with what shadows look like when they're being cast by skyscrapers at different times of the day.
Yeah.
And this is being built at the foot of these towers in Dubai. I'm pretty sure that that is simply the shadow of a nearby skyscraper being cast across the parking lot and the set.
Oh, I think so too. But the interesting thing also is underneath that structure, there's a lot of debris that they have kind of stored there. So I'm wondering if this is some type of crash landed ship that has basically like torn itself like into whatever structure that it hit. So again, it's exciting to see, but it's really tough to kind of speculate with this type of tidbit of information. And you never know like how that the rumor ball starts rolling, because and especially in your head canon, because now you're like, oh, what happened? Is that the front of some type of Federation ship or shuttlecraft or alien ship? Where did it land? How did it land? Who did it land with?
I think it's the Vengeance A, Norm. The Vengeance A.
if that's true, then does that mean it's only, is it four times larger, or do they kind of spend all of their resources on the Vengeance so it's only two times larger? Are they dialing that back?
The Starfleet section? I'm trying to calculate in my head. I'm trying to figure out. What, and I'm trying 31? To think of how large the structure would have to be for them to build a four times larger ship inside this structure so that it's hidden from anyone passing by.
I think Section 31 blew their budget on the Vengeance. Now they're only going to maybe one times larger.
And I'm also wondering that if the saucer section were four times larger and it had a hole in the middle, would that be structurally sound, or would the saucer just kind of snap in half and then fall to the sides?
We only know if that's for true certain if we're doing combat in atmosphere, because then structural integrity in space kind of really doesn't matter.
Okay.
So, and I can hear like 1,000 people like out there saying like, it does matter. I'm like, well, kind of it doesn't, because there's no gravity in space, but I'm just saying.
All right. Well, we'll find out where this is going. But Norm, what's really fun about this is the speculating, because it's fun when you go back a few years from now and you re-listen to this episode and you hear us talking about what this might be. And that leads me to a review that we received of the Ready Room here about a week ago. And normally I read reviews when we get them at the end of the show, but because it kind of relates to this, I'm going to go ahead and do this right now. So everyone, if you want to support the show, one thing that really helps us is if you leave us a star rating and a written review in iTunes. And I specify iTunes because that's the place that has the best infrastructure for doing this. And also about 82% of all podcast consumption is through iTunes and iOS devices. So please don't get offended if you're an Android user when I mention iTunes, but that's why I bring it up. But leaving us a star rating and a written review really helps us a lot, helps people find the show, helps us rise up in the search results and such. So Norm, we recently got a review from Gruffy Winters, and Gruffy left us a 5-star rating and said, can't imagine a better Trek podcast. Now listen to what he says, and this is how it ties in to why speculation is great. I'm completely addicted to the Ready Room. I found it from a listing of other Trek FM shows included in a different Trek FM podcast. Checked out the first episode from, I believe, 5 years ago. Yep, that's about right. And was hooked immediately. Now I'm furiously trying to catch up. Actually, I listened to the most recent one and then backtracked to the older shows. Looking forward to finding out who the villain is going to be in Star Trek II. Pretty sure it's not going to be Khan. Ha!
That's awesome.
So we had great fun there, because at first we were thinking there's no way they're going to be doing Khan. They can't possibly go there. And then later I actually knew it was Khan because of some, you know, news I had heard from here and there. But I still was pretending it wasn't, because I don't want to spoil it for people. And so we were going on and on about how it's not Khan. And so, yeah, but that's what's fun, right? You get to go back and listen to us speculating that initially Benicio del Toro was going to play a South Talosian police officer who was going to be trying to stop the flow of drugs from South Talos to North Talos. And then we had all kinds of other speculation.
Well, I mean, I can't wait until I'm proven wrong and just basically someone's going to tell me that this is just a really dilapidated Ractigino stand. So
that's what it's going to turn out to be.
Yeah.
So. All right. So Gruffy goes on with, Chris is amazing. I can't get over how much he does in his wonderful creation of Trek FM. Well, thank you, Gruffy, but I do it with a lot of other people. So thank you to everyone who helps with that. His format in the Ready Room of a section of current Trek news discussion with co-host Greg. Spoiler alert, Gruffy, Greg does leave around show 84, so there are actually more Ready Rooms without him. But we had a great time doing the show together for all those episodes. Followed by a panel discussion of a particular topic from the Trek universe with rotating guests. Now there's a visual. He sees you guys spinning around. Keeps the talk fresh and exposes the listener to other Trek FM hosts of shows they may not have checked out yet. And the musical selections that transition the news section into the discussion are interesting. One critique, I wish he'd announce what the piece of music is in each show. but I also have the feeling that they are listed and I just haven't found them yet. Okay, so Gruffy, in that case, the deal is the vast majority of that music is just royalty-free film music. So there's, I mean, they have titles, but it's not anything that you would know. It's just royalty-free music that I throw in. And the stuff with people singing, that's usually five-year mission, however, when we're doing TOS episodes. So you can go to iTunes or any music marketplace or their website, fiveyearmission.net, and you can find out how to get their albums there. As a TOS baby who sort of lost her way following Next Gen, oh, I'm sorry, I've been referring to Gruffy as he all this time. Gruffy is actually she. Something about Gruffy made me think, you know. There was that. So, okay, so she says, as a TOS baby who sort of lost her way following Next Gen, I've been inspired to binge the shows I missed in their first run, aside from various episodes here and there, and am experiencing a rebirth of my great love of Star Trek. Hmm. Also, as a person who loves humor, both snarky and silly, as well as intelligent discussion, I find the Ready Room is perfectly balanced. It manages to combine both humor and deeper conversation of the loftier side of Trek perfectly, without being too dry in its discussions or too juvenile in its silliness. Thank you, Chris and crew. So a really long, really wonderful review there. Thank you so much, Gruffy, for that.
Yeah, that was fantastic. And when I first started listening to the network, I mean, I probably would write a review very similar. I think it's very much like almost like an NPR for Trek fans. Yeah.
I listen to a lot of NPR over the years, so maybe I am a little bit influenced by that.
But it's a good format. It's nice to have news and then nice to have a feature, and then it's nice to keep things lively in our rotating chairs as we rotate here through the network hosts. So
that's quite a visual, Norm.
So it's like what Spock said. It's like the lilies of the field. They toil not, neither do they spin. So
that's right. Nice tying it back into Trek there.
Thank you very much.
So we had one more review. And this is, on the flip side, a very short review, which we also love. This is from Holodeck Addict. So I guess it must be from Barclay, right?
It must be.
It must be. Holodeck Addict left us 5 stars and said, very entertaining. I am a Trek fan. I listen to this podcast to become a Trekker. Just kidding. But this show is very informative and entertaining. So I think maybe that was a Trek fan /Trekkie/Trekker joke there, perhaps.
Not a boomer, or a boomer niner, perhaps, right. But definitely a Trekkier fan. I'm not sure how that works.
So, Holodeck Addict and Gruffy Winters, both, thank you so much for your reviews. And for everyone else, please head over and leave us a review. I really appreciate hearing what you think about the show. Mm-hmm. All right, Norm, let's bring in Mike and Will and talk about E2. During Enterprise's 3rd season, the crew's mission to find the Zindi superweapon took an unexpected turn when they encountered themselves. Well, not exactly themselves, but their offspring. In a time travel story that had nothing to do with the temporal Cold War, Archer stumbled upon a helping hand in the form of Trip and T'Pol's son, and along the way, the crew caught a glimpse of what their personal lives would or could become. And today, we're going to talk about this episode, E2, and to help us do that, of course, we have Boomer Niner himself.
My new Twitter handle, just for Trek FM.
That's right. New Twitter handle for the co-host of Warp 5, our Enterprise show, as well as the network's content manager, Will Wynn. Will, thanks for joining us.
Of course. I'm just glad that I didn't have to wait 100 years to join you.
Yeah, I know. You'd be flying around. You would just be walking around your house for about 100 years until I started the Zoom meeting.
Yeah, it's gone by pretty fast.
Also joining us for the first time here on the Ready Room, a voice some of you have heard on the Patrons Roundtable, and someone who maybe will bring us a little philosophical twist to this discussion of E2 is Mike Morrison. Mike, welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be on the Ready Room. Just want to say I traveled actually back in time to be here for this Ready Room today, so good to be here.
Was anyone shooting at you or chasing you when you went back in time?
No, but strangely enough, I was warned that if I took certain actions, I would end up in the 21st century.
If you walk through that door, you will be thrown back in time.
Only a 22% chance, though.
I have a hard head. What can I say?
All right. I'd say that's a pretty good chance right there.
And also, Chris, if I can interject, because this is a Warp 5-ish crew, Mike is an associate producer for the show for Warp 5.
Oh, that's right.
So... except for, with the exception of Floyd and Jeff, you're looking at the crew, not the crew's, I guess, successors or children or people that have to wait 100 years for us to show up again, but the actual crew. So we're all here.
We're all here. And I used to host Warp 5 myself.
That's right. So that's right.
There we go. There's a whole Warp 5 gang here.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, before we get into the discussion, let's give a brief synopsis of this episode for those who haven't seen it. And this happens towards the end of the third season. The NX-01 is in the Expanse. They're searching for the Zindi weapon. They're on their way to meet Degra. And suddenly they encounter another NX-class starship, which turns out to be the Enterprise, which had been thrown back more than 100 years during an attack when they're trying to use a shortcut to meet up with Degra. And they have to work together with their descendants to successfully reach the rendezvous point so they can continue on their journey to find the Zindi superweapon. Of course, there's some conflict there between Archer and Lorian, who is Tripping T'Pol's son, who is now in command of the Enterprise, the other Enterprise. And in the end, our crew, Archer's crew, present day, I say that as if we are there in the 22nd century ourselves, they make it through and they meet up with Degra, who tells Archer that you're early. And Archer has no words for that other than a look that says, if you only knew what I just went through to get here. So that is basically what happens in this episode, but there's a lot of character stuff in here that we're going to discuss. So let's start off with our initial thoughts. Will, what are your first thoughts on E2?
You know, it actually works in a lot of ways, and it's crazy. I think a lot of season 3 is like that. I think a lot of it is when you hear it on paper, it shouldn't work, but I think if you watch it with the right perspective and watch it within a specific time frame or, you know, like I said, a different perspective, I think it works. And I think this actually works. You know, what you said in the beginning, this is a time travel story that isn't part of the temporal Cold War, and it's layered in very deep into season 3. And yet, at least for me personally, I think it works really well as a personal story. It works really well because you're introducing two new characters that aren't part of the main crew, and yet they supplement the rest of the cast. And I think the rest of the cast gets to shine in interesting ways. So I think it's an episode that, on paper, would sound like, oh, they're really just running out of ideas, right? But for me, I actually really liked the interplay that that Lorian had, older T'Pol had, the rest of the older crew. I think it introduced really interesting concepts, and they're able to do it really deep into a very serialized Zindi arc. It's very standalone. I think it's obviously you would understand more if you were watching the Zindi arc, but I think it works when it really shouldn't on paper.
Yeah. Let's not forget there are also 30 new characters who are all descendants of Phlox.
That's true. That's true.
Without Feasel. So, hey.
Right.
You know.
Right. Apparently, I don't know how Feasel's going to feel about Amanda, but apparently Amanda really loves her some Phlox.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're good there. Oh, he's good there.
Right.
He is good there.
Okay. Mike, what are your thoughts on E2?
Yeah, this episode works really well for me. It's a great standalone episode, like Will said, and that's not to say that it's a bad episode. This particular episode draws from, I think, a familiar well. There's some interesting character stories within this particular episode. We look at the relationship between Tripp and T'Pol interestingly enough, to Paul and to Paul, that scene was very interesting. So there's some excellent story going on here. And then, hey, you know, when we think about Phlox and Amanda Cole, I mean, you know, my goodness, that's a story that really should be told.
I'm picturing a law firm called To Paul and To Paul.
To Paul and To Paul.
They use logic in order to get the best settlement for you.
I mean, we've been talking about a Star Trek space lawyer show for so long. I feel like it's got to happen at some point.
Right.
I'm thinking more like Phlox, Fiesel, and Cole. I think that's a really good, that's a good start. I think in any perspective, whether it's a law firm or whatever.
Do they specialize in handling sexual harassment cases?
I think that's probably one of their top positions, if you get my drift. But if not, then I shall stop right here.
Okay, well, so. Tell us your initial thoughts here. You mentioned, Norm, to me that, and Mike said they drew upon a familiar mold here for a time travel story. And you mentioned that this has a bit of a feel of Yesterday's Enterprise, even.
Yeah, you know, when I was looking at this episode, again, one of the things that really struck me was it was an insular episode. It was a bottled episode. And it had the ability to tell a character-driven story. In this case, characters that we care about. You know, we care about the relationship between Trip and T'Pol. Even though Archer is featured in the episode and Archer's descendants, it's not really an episode for him. It's really kind of an introspective thing. Like, what is a what if? And it's a great opportunity to do it because, Will, you said this earlier, even though in a little bit jest, you said that it's the expanse. It's the Delphic expanse and things can happen. Spatial and temporal mechanics may be askew from what we know because I'm a huge fan of temporal mechanics shows like Doctor Who and Continuum. So when I saw this, it did have a little bit of a resonance of Yesterday's Enterprise when the Enterprise came through the portal. I thought that something would change. I thought that the linear mechanic would change, and it really didn't. And I was kind of wondering why. And that did set my attention on edge a little bit more than I usually have watching an episode because I wanted to see if they were going to go a certain way. And like in Cause and Effect, I love Cause and Effect because they kept figuring out over and over and over how to defeat what was going on in terms of the temporal mechanic. And it worked in all the different acts as it escalated.
Like in this episode, they could have a scene where T'Pol has to meditate part of their way through the loop, and she keeps knocking a candle over every time.
Or she keeps finding a neural pressure point that actually starts to work and one that doesn't work, you know, with Trip, maybe. You know, but you know, we say that. You know, the funny thing is we say that in jest, but it all could work because that's, I think, and missed opportunity in this show because they had the two T'Pols and they're Vulcan and they have that ability to telepathically link through time and through space. Yeah. And that's the way that they could have probably told the story. But just to go back to an earlier thing that you said, I think a really interesting title for this show could have been The Descendants.
Yeah.
I think that would have been really neat. Mm-hmm. And I'm not exactly sure what E2 means for everybody. I'm thinking of Enterprise Squared.
Yeah, squared. That's what it means. I'm certain. But
it means decon E gel squared, guys. Obviously,
that's the best. It's the best.
That's
shell
the
squared.
Super strength one.
So, right. But that's where I was hoping. I was hoping it was getting more into a cause and effect, and Yesterday's Enterprise kind of feel.
Well, I could see a scene where the way we know that something has really changed is that they cut down to the kitchen and we see Chef. We actually see Chef. And he's looking like something's not right here. The fact that we actually see him, we know the timeline has changed.
And if it gets reversed, we never saw Chef to begin with. It just erases itself.
And the chef is Andy Dick. Played? Boom.
I was going to say, would Chef be played by Jonathan Frakes?
or Jonathan Frakes. But that's in the Prime universe. Yeah. It's Andy Dick in the other universe.
But Norm, for me, this felt a lot, at least to me, like Children of Time from DS9 Season 5. Again, that's not to say that it was a bad throwback or anything, because I really love this episode. I think it's, again, just drawing from a familiar well. I think I read an article a while back where Mike Sussman, he pitched an entirely different story that really involved Columbia going back in time rather than Enterprise, and it was their descendants that Enterprise would encounter. But according to the interview that I read, he was asked to revise that story to reflect, you know, what we got here in E squared. And, you know, Sussman even raised the concern that, you know, maybe, hey, maybe this is a little bit too familiar. This is a little bit too much like, you know, the DS9 story, but the EPs overruled him. But regardless, I still say it's a strong story that frankly would have worked in any season as a standalone episode.
I don't think it's overly similar to Children of Time personally, but if you take the Odo Kira element, mm-hmm. and then you look at the T'Pol Trip element, maybe a bit. Yeah. I don't think sending the Columbia back would have worked as well, though, because I think that anytime you get into, and I guess we'll go ahead and transition now into talking about this as a time travel story. Anytime you get into time travel, it can be difficult for the story to make complete sense. And this is a story where I think if you really, really think about, is this possible within the framework of what we already know about time travel stories and causality and how timelines supposedly split and all, that this story doesn't really work that well. But the strength of the story is in the character interactions and what they're able to do with T'Pol and Trip in particular. And you wouldn't be able to do that if it were the descendants of the Columbia crew that they were encountering, because there would be no question whether they themselves, and the only person that we really have to think about here, do they continue to exist or not, is T'Pol, because she is the only person still alive on that ship who's on the current ship. The fact that they can talk to each other face to face in the first place, that raises more questions, which we'll talk about later. But yeah, that's my thought on that. But I like the way it worked out, even though it doesn't make total sense as a time travel story, because we do get to see how T'Pol in particular reacts to things that happened to her in the past.
I mean, I have to say that this is another one of those really nice moments where I have to give Jolene Blaylock a lot of credit. I mean, her ability to play the elderly T'Pol was just fantastic. I mean, she had really great nuance in her performance, and I think she really embraced and studied, probably did some character study on some elderly, and tried to figure out, like, you know, she had like a nice little shimmy in her hands when she was holding the pad and handing that over. There were just like nice moments. And you don't really see that, I mean, or really think about that when you look at Jolene Blaylock as Jolene Blaylock, because she's this gorgeous supermodel. But to boil it all down, it's just another feather in her cap of the performances that she had throughout the four seasons. I think she grew fantastically as a thespian.
I honestly think this is one of her top five performances in the series. And again, to restate the fact that she wasn't an actor before doing Enterprise in any real regard, I think it's just phenomenal, the performance she gave in this particular episode.
Yeah, I think the interplay is, it's important because you get to see it affects how T'Pol is going to be going forward. And I think that's going to be something we're going to talk about later in this show. But I think it's informing not only her character in that particular time period, but it's going to inform her character when she, the real, quote unquote, the real T'Pol, when she goes back to her correct time. It's going to continue her development that you're going to see in season four.
What did you guys think about how Mike Sussman connected this story so that it tied in a little bit with what happened before? I'm thinking particularly of the line where Archer tells his great granddaughter or great great granddaughter?
I think it's just one great.
Great great.
Okay.
I think it's one great.
One great, two greats, but his granddaughter, that their presence explains a number of things, like when the Zindi were interrogating him and they wanted to know how many ships Starfleet has in the expanse. You know, just that little line makes you think that, wow, you know, they've been out there all this time. They've been out there long before the Zindi ever decided they needed to destroy Earth. We've just never heard from them before or heard about them before.
And I thought that was a really interesting plot point, because when the Enterprise went back in time, they had to create all of these protocols. We can't disrupt our own time stream. We can't influence our own time stream. They had the ability to basically reforge Starfleet if they wanted to exercise their influence on that. So from Mike Sussman's standpoint, I'm glad that they thought about how disruptive the Enterprise back in that time could have been. I mean, they really were an entire century of advanced technology in that space before anything really was ever happening. They could have destroyed the sphere builders if they wanted to. I mean, technically. So maybe that's where I think they lost an opportunity here to really fit this into the temporal Cold War, because it could have been part of the B plot of this story where all of this was happening, but it was happening because it was according to some type of plan that Daniels was executing.
Okay. Yeah,
later on.
That's what I was going to say. How do we know that them being thrown back in time wasn't part of a plan by one faction in the temporal Cold War?
Yeah.
But they didn't know it. Right. Because
right.
Although they should have a Daniels on the ship, but at this point he's, you know, gone. So
I think that just reiterates the point of how the temporal Cold War can be very, it can go in fits and starts. I think that's the, I think here it's a missed opportunity for them to slot this in. I think that's the whole point, is that they themselves didn't really know where the Cold War was going. So they didn't think to just put this in there. And I think that's one of the big challenges for me with Enterprise, is there are parts where you can really tell that they are writing it as they go. And it somehow works. I think the overall product, and of course, I'm on Warp 5, so I'm a fan of the show, and I think it works in a lot of ways. But there are parts where you can definitely tell that they are just throwing this together as they go along. And the Temporal Cold War is a huge example of that. And Norman brings up a really good point. Like, this is something they could kind of bring into, but they didn't really think of it, because I could easily see them saying, we just need to do an episode. Why don't we do like an alternate take on a time travel episode? Can we fit it into the Zindi arc? Can that burn us an episode? And it ends up being really good and being a really great bottle episode in a way. But I could just see them. That was the genesis of the idea. We need to come up with an alternate timeline, a time travel story, fit it in somewhere, make it work.
But here's the interesting thing, and I'm going to redirect this one to you, Mike, because I think you want to talk about a little bit of this. When a writer brings up an idea of a story in this season that harkens to time travel episode, why wouldn't they put that on their storyboard, on their architecture for the overarching plotline for not just season 3, but for Enterprise, and say, hey, we have this temporal Cold War going on too, which is a complete time travel dynamic. How can we fit that in? I mean, Mike, what do you think that they were maybe or maybe not thinking when they were writing this episode?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the fact that they were kind of flying by the seat of their pants, and there's no doubt this was a missed opportunity. I think that happened in the planning stages, as far as the producer's concerned, to put that on a writer like Mike Sussman. You know, first of all, you know, Mike Sussman is a Trekkie. He's a fan. And we see that time after time in his writing. He finds little ways to work in nuances and to tie plot points together from other shows, sometimes even other series. I've seen that in his writing. So as a writer, he's really brilliant. And I think that if he had been given that freedom, I have no doubt he would have done that, because it goes so well with his own style. But again, we're back to how well was this planned out? I don't think there was a storyboard. I don't think there was a whiteboard or anything else that they were really looking at. They were just, you know, we're going to come in, we're going to try to throw an episode together and hope to God it sticks. And I think that's what we see here, not just in the third season, but, you know, the first two seasons, certainly.
Yeah, I find that really interesting, though, because in terms of the production costs of shows like this, when you're dealing with, and Will, the reason why I'm bringing this up, because we actually talked about this on our episode when we were talking on Warp 5, when we were talking about different ship designs, because you technically are creating a whole digital asset with the other Enterprise, because it was an amalgamation of different types of technologies over the course of time and they were in the Expanse. So you have this asset that they have to create in terms of a production cost. So if they can do that, if they can greenlight the money to create new digital assets, why wouldn't they take the time and the opportunity to be able to see a little bit further into why they're creating this story and fit this into the timeline? again, it's like, yes, they say it's not like they're writing this because we just need to fling out some pages. I mean, there is a cost associated with every single one of these episodes. And if you're going to hire new cast and script new SAG actors and create new assets, you have to be able to say, hey, you know what? Let's take a look at this from a broader spectrum. And how does this fit into our budget? So I kind of understand, like, yes, they were writing and they didn't really have a whole overarching plan, but they still have to be able to have somebody sign the check when it comes to all of these assets.
That sounds like a great question Brandon Braga could answer, right? We should definitely have him on to answer that. No,
somebody tweet that out.
I know. I totally get where you're coming from, Norm. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, but I think it still boils down to just they were running out of ideas. Even in season three, you know, we did our Blu-ray show about the behind the scenes. Like, they were running out of gas. And, you know, I it would have made a lot of sense because I think the Lauren character and the characters that they brought forward could have been one of those arcs that we saw in season four. It could have been a 2-episode or 3-episode story. It was the meat was there for it to develop into a more substantive multi-part episode. I just think that they wanted to do a diversion from the Zindi arc just for one episode, and that's what they were able to do, and they had the money to do it. Because I think at that point, they're like, you know what? We may even be canceled after this show, after this season, so why not? And I don't know. I don't know if there's a deeper meaning behind that.
Probably not. It's just one of those kind of... It does you know, make you kind of scratch the itch on the back of your head and say, you know... Well, we always say this on our show. It was the series that could have been, you know, the opportunities that were missed. But yeah. I don't want to digress too far.
I don't know. For me, this episode is so much about Trip and T'Pol that element, I don't know. I mean, I can ask Mike if that was what he was thinking in the revision of this. But obviously, his original story with the Columbia going back was not this. But it ends up being so much about Trip and T'Pol to me that I don't think that it needs to be tied into the temporal Cold War. I mean, they could have, and maybe that would have made a nice, neat bow on it. But I don't think that was necessarily on their minds. You know, when you're asking, like, why didn't they decide to do that if they're going to create new visual assets for the ship and spend money on that, so... one thing I want to go back to before we get off the time travel part, Norm, you mentioned that the Enterprise crew, when they got thrown back in time, they have to start creating protocols and thinking about how their presence would affect the timeline and affect the future. And it is interesting within Star Trek because at this point, they really, even in the 22nd century, they really have no concept of that and nothing like that, because we see that even in the 24th century, Starfleet is just really starting to wrap their minds around what it means when you travel through time and what rules should be put into place. Because even in Voyager, they're kind of surprised when they find out that, well, in the future, there's this thing called the Temporal Prime Directive, right? So it takes Starfleet a long time to evolve rules about how you interact with time. They might teach classes at the academy in the 23rd century, like, be careful if you go back, you know, if you're with Kirk, he likes to go back in time, be careful, you know, watch out. But it's not something that they're really, really understanding yet. So the fact that Archer's crew gets thrown back into the 21st century and starts thinking about this is an interesting angle on the episode.
Well, I thought that was one of the nicer pieces of writing. It was a very intelligent piece because they didn't dwell on it for so long. And at the time, the Vulcan High Command disavowed time travel.
It's impossible, Norm.
It's impossible.
It's not possible.
That's right. It is the opposite of possible.
That's right.
T'Pol and older T'Pol probably would have debated at that time.
Right. See, on Earth, on Phineas and Ferb say that the only thing that is impossible is impossibility. But when they air Phineas and Ferb on Vulcan, they had to change it. The only thing that is impossible is impossibility and time travel.
And this is why time travel is so convoluted in any show that you ever watch, ever.
That timey-wimey stuff hurts my brain.
Section 31 really was created to stop time travelers. It really was. You know, let's be honest, because Luther Sloan was in Section 31.
It's true.
And
I think we did miss an opportunity to have a little Doctor Who crossover here. I mean, River Song shows up and says, spoilers. But seriously, I mean, we did miss an opportunity where I think there could have been a moral dilemma for Archer in terms of how quickly he came to that decision. You know, we don't want to influence a timeline. We're going to influence the timeline here. So no, we can't really go back to Earth. It was just so quickly he came to that conclusion. I think we missed an opportunity to have a little bit of a moral dilemma. I could see this particular episode really becoming a two-part arc, where they kind of explore those things a little bit.
Do you think he would have wrestled with it a little bit more like he did with Damage and taking the warp engine, you know, from the stranded ship, because he wrestled with that?
Yeah, indeed. He had many struggles with his conscience, with his ethics throughout the course of season three. So why wouldn't he stop for a second, pause, think this through, throw out, you know, some ideas, you know, hey, maybe we can stop this attack. Maybe we can influence this here and now. I think that was just a missed opportunity.
Well, do you think that as they get closer to the deadline, because this episode is two episodes after Damage, that Archer, and especially after he made that decision in Damage, he just feels that urgency that whatever it takes, I have to make sure that I make the rendezvous. I have to stop the weapon. Because you see that in Lorian as well. I mean, Lorian is willing to kill his ancestors in order to complete the mission. So I think that the knowledge that Earth is going to be destroyed is driving them both to make quicker decisions and maybe dispense with that struggle that they might have with those decisions.
I don't know that he would have come to it that quickly, because again, the struggles, the moral, the ethical struggles that he had throughout season three, I think we see Archer wrestling with these larger issues, and I definitely think that there was urgency there for both him and Lorian, but I see him wrestling with this a little bit more.
Let's talk about one other thing that's sort of related here. It's related to the fact that they get thrown back in time, and then they state that they knew that it would be their descendants who completed the mission, and so the Enterprise became a generational ship, which is, of course, what many of us think Voyager should have done when it got stranded as well, and it didn't. But here they do make that decision, which seems like a more realistic course of action. Do you have any thoughts or any comments on how that played out? I mean, we don't see so much of it in the episode, but just thinking about the fact that they did that, because we're seeing them 100 years after they made that decision.
I think it's a really great concept, and it could have really been another series. The other series would have been Voyager, or Voyager was the first to come up with this concept, but it raises such interesting questions. And I think even within the 45 minutes that this is in, and only the few scenes we see of what the generational ship means, I think it's so interesting to see like what happens to the crew, the fact that only a third are women, they start pairing off, what's going to happen, what type of technology they have to incorporate. They have a database of different alien technologies they've been accumulating in the expanse. It's rife with such really great narrative potential. And I think a lot of ways Voyager would have benefited from that. I think it's something. I think having a generational ship adds a grittiness, or it adds a kind of scrappiness to the Enterprise, where it doesn't seem as polished. It doesn't seem like they have all the answers. I'm not saying that, you know, the Enterprise that we got, they had all the answers either, and it was easy for them. But I like the fact that they had to kind of jury-rig things together. They have hodgepodge it together. And for me, that's what I really wanted Enterprise to be. I wanted Enterprise to be like, this is the first time they're in space. Things are really dangerous. They're going to have to be able to barter with aliens, figure out how technologies work together, don't work together the hard way. I think it was what I wanted to see from the original concept of Enterprise, is that they're out there, they're going to have to figure things out, and things are going to be very dirty, and they're going to have to make compromises. And for me, I think it was a really great concept. Admittedly, we only saw it for one episode, but I really love what they did with it.
There were a lot of textures going on when they were describing and showing what was going on with the generational ship. And two things actually struck out to me really, really clearly. One, this is a boomer ship now.
That's what this exactly. Is, oh, took the yeah. words from my mouth. Exactly.
It was a boomer ship. This is what a long deep space travel cargo ship would have been, mm-hmm. you know, and the other thing that actually struck me was that it started to trend a little bit more towards New Battlestar Galactica, because when they were talking about we had to start creating families in order for us to perpetuate our mission, it brought me back to this really great scene. And I don't remember a lot of Battlestar Galactica, but I do remember this one scene where President Roslin, or was it just Roslin at the time, she looked at the crew and she just said, babies. It's like, you're going to have to start having babies.
Yeah, it's because early on when she has that whiteboard. She is president, yeah. I think.
Yeah, right. I think she's president at that point. But yeah, it's early on, yeah.
And that just reminded me of that. And it was a smart piece of writing, because if they're going to perpetuate their mission and fulfill this bridge from one time stream to where they need to return, they have to have a succession plan, mm-hmm. quote unquote. But that also creates an interesting level of zealotry in the crew as well, because that's where Lorian is at. Lorian is complete the mission at all costs without seeing the variables that may help you complete the mission if something changes. And from a Vulcan standpoint, it was really interesting to see him wrestle with the logic that's T'Pol's and the instinct that's Tripp's. And that's where the actor who played Lorian really did a great job at bridging, I think, a different interpretation of what Spock was. Hmm. Because Spock was trained in the Kulinar process, and he was able to purge his emotional state and control that. Lorian, technically, in terms of his DNA and chemistry, was that hybrid. And neat to see, because we haven't seen a human hybrid Vulcan yet, until now. But he wasn't in the Spock track, because Spock was trained.
Right. You know, Let's talk a little bit more about that, because one thing I have on the outline that I really noticed this time because I was watching for it is that David Andrews playing Lorian, it really seemed like he had studied Connor Treneer and how he plays Tripp and worked that into everything from the way he speaks to his mannerisms. Even when they come up and they are working on, I think they're the injectors, but the two of them are there and they're both working, and the way he's got his head turned, it feels like Tripp getting in there. And so even though he mentions that Tripp died when Lorian was 14, and so he didn't get that hands-on training in terms of being an engineer, he would have had plenty of influence from Tripp as his father up to age 14. And so much about his character and just the way he speaks and everything would be influenced by that. And I really felt that. Did you guys see that as well?
Absolutely. I think you could definitely see it in you know, everyone was referencing, you know, the kind of
right
eyes.
Here between the eyes.
Exactly. And, yeah. you know, it down to the mannerisms and the facial expressions, it was really well done, because it was very nuanced, but it was very noticeable if you were looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
That scene's a little tough for me, particularly to watch. You know, my dad wasn't around during my growing up years. He left when I was 5, and I didn't really see him again, except briefly on my 13th birthday, really until I was really well into my teens. Our relationship wasn't very good, really, until the last couple of years before he died. I was 22 at the time, and he had a heart attack just a few days before his 50th birthday. So, you know, when Lorian says to Tripp that he was a good father, and he says, you know, it's strange being able to tell you that, I really find myself thinking about, you know, what I'd say to my own dad if I had the chance. And watching that scene reminds me that even though my dad wasn't there to influence me, it's funny because I say things and I see things in my mannerisms sometimes that I think to myself, my God, that's, you know, that's my dad. My dad would have said that. That was something my dad would have done. That scene in particular is tough for me. But otherwise, you know, David Andrews, he does such a great job, you know, balancing the halves of his character. And I think you're right, Chris. I think he was really studying Connor Treneer. he there's a little bit of the Southern accent, but not too much.
Yeah, but not too much, right?
So there's this great balance there. And I'm really glad that he didn't try to go movie-era Spock, you know, with the character. But I got to tell you, he sort of felt a little Romulan for me, especially in the brig scene with Archer.
I can see that. Yeah, now that you mention it, yeah.
Well, again, that's going back to the untrained Vulcan, you know, because...
So here we are, everyone. You heard it from Norm. Romulans are simply untrained Vulcans.
I don't think I'm the first person to have said that.
A Romulan would kill you for saying that, by the way.
They're undisciplined Vulcans. You know, I'm not sure if I can add any more to that because David Andrews was fantastic in the role. He's very magnetic, especially around the eyes.
Yeah.
You know, the ears were his mom's. No, but he's a very, very strong actor. He's definitely schooled in being able to turn his method on and to emulate the personalities that he was created by, i.e. Tripp and T'Pol. You're right, he didn't play up the Southern accent too much because Tripp was only there for so long. And he was able to understand through his formative years engineering and just his role in the ship. And I think that because Archer relied on Tripp so much, Lorian may have felt that responsibility as leader of the ship, because since Archer wasn't around anymore and Archer didn't have a male heir, I don't know if that played a role in terms of the hierarchy of the ship, but somewhere along the line, that instinct of Lorian's kicked in. And just a small point, I'm just really curious why they chose that name, because it's such a strong Tolkien name.
Well, I think that's the origin of it, actually.
Yeah. And in Babylon 5, there was one of the more important characters later on was a character named Lorian, and J. Michael Straczynski is a well-known Tolkien aficionado and fan. So choosing something like that, choosing a name like that, and not either a human or a Vulcan name, I always thought was interesting.
Well, I think it's all in the ears, you know.
I love how...
Are you saying that all Vulcans have pointy ears?
It just leads you to that elvish realm.
It's so epic and it's so like mystical sounding. What if his name was Chester? Or just some random name you wouldn't expect, like, you know, Chet.
Or Charles Tucker.
You know what I mean? I know.
You know, just something like that.
I just think
Chester like, Tucker.
Charles Tucker the fourth.
Like, could you take a Chester seriously? I think it would be, I think it's just funny that Lorian is a very regal sounding name. It has a Tolkien origin, okay. But it could have been anything, right? It could have been anything.
Well, it's a good thing it wasn't like Bilbo or Strider. I mean, that would have gone a little too far.
It'd be
right?
So obvious. You know?
They could have named him Charles Tucker the fourth, and then this episode could have been titled T-squared.
Oh, T-squared.
Dig it.
Okay. The fourth.
Well, speaking of the name of this episode, I find this really funny. The things you find on Memory Alpha. Someone pointed out that this is actually the shortest title of any Star Trek episode. It's shorter than Voyager's Q-squared by half a character because the two is superscript.
We're number one.
Really? Okay.
The crazy thing is that there had to be a patient zero. There had to be the first person to make that realization. Who is right. That insane person, right? There had to be a person somewhere in time that was like they made that realization and wrote it down on Memory Alpha for the internet to see.
Someone who's a typographer.
Yeah. They were waiting around and walking around their living room for 111 years just to be able to put that on the internet.
Right. They've been waiting and waiting. Yeah.
And that person can die now. He's all like, you know what? He or she was like, you know what? I fulfilled my life purpose.
I think they tried earlier, but their mission failed because one of the editors of Memory Alpha deleted it as not being canon. Good. So, yes. All right. Well, let's talk about Tripp and T'Pol themselves just a little bit here. I already mentioned, for me, this episode is very much about them. It's interesting to watch the dynamic between them and neither one of them believing that they would actually end up together. But at the same time, when I'm watching it, you know, the way it's played, I mean, I feel that dynamic between them. Like, they both have feelings for each other, but they're trying, especially T'Pol, trying to push it away. Especially at the beginning, where T'Pol doesn't want to help him anymore with the neuropressure. Like, you've learned all you can, you know. Go ahead and get out of here. What do you feel about specifically how this episode forwards that relationship?
I think from a writing standpoint, it's obvious that they're trying to move the relationship along. But again, I feel it's really Jolene's performance and how she just nails it in terms of letting T'Pol's emotions come to the surface without, you know, letting them come out completely. The elder T'Pol mentions, you know, in the tea scene with the younger T'Pol, I call it the T'Pol tea scene, that Tripp stirred up these powerful emotions. And really watching Jolene through that whole episode, it's just like watching a potter at the wheel or a painter at the canvas. You know, she plays that so well. She's got this palette of emotion that's right there on the surface, you know, just waiting for it to dip a brush in, but she never puts it on. It's an art form. It's incredible. She really, this whole episode, she was just right on her game in terms of playing those emotions, but not letting them come out. And I think, at least for me, that's what made this such a strong episode in terms of her coming to the realization that she did feel as strongly as she did and accepting that because of the wise counsel of Elder T'Pol.
You know, I felt that from her also when she was sitting in her chair next to Brandon Braga at the cast reunion discussion they have on the Blu-rays. Like, I don't really want to be here. I'm not going to let those emotions boil over too much.
Yeah.
She was tapping
all
into
about
character
that on our Blu-ray special. Just the body language was so tense.
She was tapping
right?
into character.
Right.
But I think you're dead right, Mike, in the sense of you're dead on in saying that it was such a subtle but powerful performance. I think Jolene doesn't get enough credit. I think unfairly in the earlier seasons kind of got characterized as someone that couldn't act or that... And I think a lot of it had to do with the roles that she was given or the types of the script she was given. But later on, as her character developed, I think she just became such a fantastic character because the actor herself has evolved and developed so well. And this, I think, you're also right in saying that the scene in her quarters when they're having tea has to be a top five T'Pol moment. It's so well done. It's the same actor playing this. But it's such a different role, but the same person. And it was just played wonderfully. And for me, I think it was bittersweet because I think this is one of the best examples of how the Tripp and T'Pol relationship worked. But knowing in season four, knowing what happens, we really don't get a resolution to that. And I think it's so frustrating because you know that this is going to play out in a certain way, but we really don't get to see it. We see it kind of stepping up to that, but we never really see it fulfilled in the way that I think the potential for both Connor Trinneer and Jolene in terms of their acting potential, where the story was going to go. But I think this is really a great example of why the Tripp and T'Pol relationship works. I know some people weren't fans of it, but I think this is a great example of why it works, because there's a chemistry there and because there's layers there. They like each other, they love each other, but they're not there yet. But they're getting there, and the journey itself is going to be very memorable. It's just that we don't really see the end of that, unfortunately.
Do you think the problem a lot of fans have with that relationship is just that they wanted Sarek and Amanda to be the first Vulcan couple, so Spock is the first Vulcan-human hybrid child that's born, and the fact that it could happen earlier in the timeline just rubs them the wrong way? So they're not actually giving the writing or the acting or the relationship a chance?
Well, in my opinion, a lot of the fans, I think, at the time had an issue with the way that the Vulcans were structured in Enterprise to begin with.
Well, yeah, of course.
I mean, the first thing it was, yeah, they were too emotional. At least T'Pol was too emotional. And the barometer of the Vulcans prior to 2151 was Spock. The way that Spock interacted with Starfleet and how he was as a Vulcan himself. So when you see somebody like T'Pol access her emotions the way she did, it became jarring for people who basically said, this is what a Vulcan should be. The Vulcan should be either Spock or Tuvok or of that type of mold, yeah, the Kolinar mold. And Jolene, I think, was given probably some loose instructions in saying that this isn't really where we want to go with Vulcans. I mean, we saw that with Fusion, and we saw that with her addiction to Trillium D. and how that pretty much damaged her and her ability to be affected by her emotional states. So being able to do that, I think, if you were a TOS fan or a fan that just understood Vulcan iconography or behavior in a certain way, you'd watch this episode and say, like, that's not what Vulcans are. What are they doing?
But let's not forget, you know, also that Jolene herself grew up watching Spock and was a big fan of Spock. Mm-hmm. So she herself knew very well what that Vulcan mold was.
Right, but I know that some fans still have a... They kind of like... it's called... I think the psychological term is called the unreal valley. It's when something's so real that their mind basically has to shut down and say, no, I have to recalibrate because this isn't what it's supposed to be. When people see Leonard Nimoy's Spock smile, it's upsetting.
Yeah.
Because that's not what Spock is supposed to do. When he was being affected in the nick of time with the polywater, mm-hmm. we're like, why is he crying? Why does he have these wild emotional swings? And when T'Pol does that in certain episodes, and especially like this one, you're like, why are they letting Vulcans do this? But it's because of the journey of this character and coming to grips with who she is. You actually get to see how even the mildest of emotional swings change a Vulcan's attitude, especially how they're being received by the audience that technically, quote unquote, I air quote this, know what Vulcans are supposed to be. So her ability to be able to meter that out in her performance is extraordinary, especially knowing that she knows the Spock character really well, and also what she knows how the audience would probably react to a very emotionally disturbed Vulcan.
Well, let's close out here because we have a couple more topics we want to talk about. They're related to temporal mechanics, I guess we'll say, but they do involve T'Pol still. So I want to talk a little bit about the T'Pol T scene, as Mike calls it. T'Pol meeting T'Pol.
A lot of T's in this episode.
A lot of T's, yes. Yeah. This, I like that they get to talk to each other. I like what they talk about, and I like what it means to the characters. But I also wonder, like, how is it possible for T'Pol to be meeting herself and talking in this way? I guess we could look at the Abrams verse and, you know, how does Spock meet himself in that situation as well? But here, they're basically still on the same timeline. So they got thrown back in time, but instead of it truly splitting, it seems like they just got thrown backwards on the same timeline and they're just making their way forward again. So how does the same person meet themselves at two different ages?
I think it's the hand wavium of the Expanse where it's just... You know, it's the Expanse. Weird things happen. There's a subspace corridor.
I think when you're approaching the Expanse, actually in space, it looks like a hand just kind of like going like this, waving to confuse you, right?
Just
weird stuff going on here.
Messing things up in space-time. And I think it's really one of those things where if you think a little bit about it, it doesn't make any sense. And it just makes, I mean, much like time travel and all those time travel stories in Star Trek, like Chief O'Brien said, you know, time travel makes his head hurt. It's the same way. Like, if you just think about it, it doesn't make any sense. So it's best not to think about it. But I think you're right. There are times when they should displace each other. There should be, like Norm said earlier at the start of the show, is there a displacement in terms of yesterday's Enterprise, or is there a cause and effect type effect where they have to signal to each other because they can't exist in the same space? But in the Abrams verse, they can talk to each other past versions. How can they remember the older version of T'Pol and the crew, despite surviving going forward, there's all these unanswered questions, right? And of course, it's never really referenced again. But when you think about it, this is a pretty life altering event, meeting your offspring and knowing what happens. I mean, it should shake someone to their core. But of course, they move on and don't really talk about it ever again. But it's one of those things where time travel is such. When it's used well, it's used well. When it's not, it's not. And when it's used well, it's because the story is done so well, you forget the device in which the story is set. But when the story isn't done well, you can't ignore kind of the flaws in which, this doesn't really make a lot of sense. And that's when those stories don't work, is because the story isn't good enough to paper over the very blatant use of just a plot device, right? Where they just hand wave this scenario into existence.
Two other movies for me actually pop up as examples, as I think really good examples of how we might be able to approach this. One, I think, is one of the best time travel movies ever made, and it's called Looper. Looper was really, really smart, and
that's our Star Wars connection for the day, by the way, Hayden Christensen.
Mm-hmm. Not in Looper.
What movie was
that? That was
Jumper or something?
That was Jumper.
Looper. Sliders. Okay, my bad.
Was it Sliders?
Yeah, and Bruce Willis, but that's okay. That's
Jumper,
okay.
Looper.
Yeah,
Slider.
In there. But you know, we'll have to get into that one on the 602. But Looper, basically, it was a really good explanation of how actions of either the future or the past affects each other. Also, mm-hmm. probably the greatest time travel movie ever made, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme in Time Cop.
Oh, it's so good.
Okay, right? Okay, and I'm gonna pull a mechanic out of that movie. And basically, Ron Silver's character says that the same matter can't occupy the same space, but it can occupy the same temporal field. So I apologize to all the listeners right now, because I'm going to go really uber norm nerdy right now. Okay. So in Back to the Future 2, Doc Brown basically said that you have a linear time stream, and basically just like flip over a chalkboard, draw a timeline, one line. What happened was that in the course of the events, the Enterprise basically broke through the barrier and reset itself. So draw basically an arc going back into its own timeline, basically 100 years. That is the Enterprise that becomes a generational ship. It's still in the same timeline. So there's no real new matter yet affecting that until they come out of the rift again and reinsert themselves back into their own timeline, so that there are essentially two versions of similar matter. As long as those molecules don't really interact, then it follows the time cop dynamic of time. But technically, they shouldn't exist in their own timeline if they've been thrown back onto their own, basically their own past. So let's focus on the characters instead.
Because I'm just thinking, like, so in Cause and Effect, this is basically what happens. The Enterprise goes back 17 days, right? Like a loop, and then comes back, and then it goes back, and it comes back.
Right.
And then I'm also thinking that in actual scientific theory in the real world, that if you go far enough, there's probably a duplicate of the four of us somewhere right now recording a podcast called The Ready Room, because there are only so many combinations of matter. If the universe is infinite, everything has to eventually be duplicated somewhere. Mm-hmm. We would never come in contact with it, though, because the distance would have to be so great before you had that duplication. So the fact that they could both exist, perhaps scientifically, technically is possible, but occupying the same space and interacting with one another would not be.
I think everything was cool right up until the point where they said that they can remember what happened, because in yesterday's Enterprise, yeah, when the Enterprise C went back into the rift, Narendra 3 was reset, and then all of a sudden, the only person that really remembered was Guinan, and then eventually Sela, when we see Sela in, you know, season 5. But it was the whole, they understood what happened. Nothing really reset itself. They were just able to get mm-hmm. to the meeting with Degra a little bit earlier, and they were kind of lamenting the fact that, oh yeah, but at the cost of what? But technically, if they were able to succeed and then Lorian's mission was able to get them to that meeting, then it would have reset their past.
Well, maybe it's explained in the cutscene where T'Pol says, well, then why do we remember them? And Archer says, maybe this was just all a giant Trillium D drug trip.
And then you hear Inagata DeVita playing over the loudspeakers. Dun 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 dun.
Oh man!
I don't know, Mike. What do you think?
Yeah, we're dealing with temporal mechanics here, and yes, I mean, if we're following the popular opinion in terms of temporal mechanics, yes, these two ships should not have been able to exist in the same time and space. But let's face it; I mean, these are theories, and when you're dealing with theories, Star Trek has done this, I think, in just about every iteration. They have just blown up the the laws of temporal mechanics and back to O'Brien. It makes my head hurt. You know, we're dealing with determinism here. If you want to wax philosophical, you know, is there a predetermined causal effect here? It puts them in this time and place, and then you throw in the temporal mechanics, and really what you've got is something that resembles a bad Saturday Night Live skit. Yeah, it's crazy. But what we do get out of this is this incredible scene where T'Pol does, and again, throw out the temporal mechanics, throw out the laws of physics, throw out the philosophical arguments. You know, we have this incredible scene between T'Pol and T'Pol, that law firm that they will one day found. And again, Jolene Blaylock, she blows it out of the water. She plays the elder T'Pol so convincingly, and those sage words that she gives to herself carries a lot of weight. And I think even though it's never mentioned again, those words, when she says to her, follow your heart, there's that saying, follow your heart. And T'Pol, younger T'Pol, says, well, what if my heart doesn't know what it wants? And she says, it will in time. It will. And I think those words, I think that was a pivotal moment for the character. I think those words ripple through the rest of the series for T'Pol. So, again, temporal mechanics aside, Mike Sussman gave us a scene that I think was character defining for T'Pol.
I think it was also important when the elder T'Pol told her that the effects of the Trillium will always be with you. You know, the emotions you've unlocked will always be with you, because from that point forward, T'Pol can move forward knowing that this isn't going to change. So I really, really must learn to live with it and figure out how I'm going to handle it. Because up until then, as a Vulcan, she's still thinking that this is temporary. You know, Phlox has told her that it's probably always going to affect you, but I don't think she really believes Phlox. She really thinks that somehow things are going to be normal for her again, the way they were before. And so with herself telling her, take it from me, because I'm you, 111 years older, it's always going to be with you. She can just move forward.
And that's almost kind of like what older Spock, in Star Trek 2009 was trying to get at when he was advising Zachary Quinto, when Leonard Nimoy Spock was advising Zachary Quinto. He was just, do what you feel is right. And that's a really interesting thing for a Vulcan of his stature to say. But because of his experiences with being able to balance emotion and logic, especially with Kirk and McCoy at his side, his advice, just like older T'Pol's advice to herself, is just, look, logic is, it's not the end. It's the means.
It's only the beginning of wisdom.
Yeah, exactly. Very good. Very good. A little Star Trek 6 for you.
But
yeah,
where's my cookie, Norm? Where's my virtual cookie that I'm going to eat?
Your cookie
right
is 111 now. Years in the past. So if you want to go, you're going to have to...
You need to cone that subspace corridor again.
That's right. We're going to have to create a predetermined paradox for you to get your cookie. No, but it's true. It's a nice thing. It's a nice to see, almost like as Vulcans grow older, and I think Saval is actually trending this way in the scenes that we're seeing in Axanar. It's about experience plus logic equals the ability to act or the ability to advise. But it's not just...
They need to hang out with humans to reach that point, because Spock is around humans, T'Pol is around humans, Saval is around humans.
That's what Archer said to older T'Pol. It's like, you've been around humans for too long. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting thing. I think it's almost a... I mean, I know, Mike, it's like we could throw this into the philosophical dimension of Star Trek, but there is an interesting predetermined, predestinationed mechanic, if you will, that the Vulcans found us maybe at the time that they needed us most.
Yeah, indeed. I think that is an excellent example of determination in Star Trek. It was meant to be. In fact, if we want to go to First Contact, we're going to jump to, jump in time to First Contact. That moment in history, at the very moment that you thought, it's not going to happen. Determination, they found a way to make it happen. You know, the Borg, and we're left wondering, is this the way it should have always been? So there's here it is again in this episode. We're seeing this. Is this the way it was always supposed to be? That beautiful picture of determination, just kind of guiding the events to make sure that everything turns out the way it's supposed to in the end. It is. It's a great philosophical discussion.
Well, we have passed an hour, so there are more things we could talk about, especially if we stay on this temporal mechanics determinism thing here. But we'll talk about that more some other time. So let's wrap up with our final thoughts and our ratings for this episode. So, Norm, how about you?
I really like this episode. I mean, aside from the temporal mechanics that we've been talking about and comparing it to other series and other pieces of works that handle that probably a little bit better, I agree with Mike with what you're saying. It's like when you really boil down this episode is about characters. It's about relationships, and it's about how those relationships helped tell the story at the time, but also kind of like inform the characters of either who they were or who they're going to become. And that's really at the heart of good storytelling. It's about the characters. It's not about all of the trappings and all of the distractions that science fiction can bring to a series. And I just think that at the heart of this, the anchor of this particular episode really is Jolene. I think that we can all agree on that. She really, yeah. Because she was given so much to work with, and because of her gravitas as the elder stateswoman of the show and of that generational ship, it was just really just a gift to be able to watch what she did. So for me, overall, I think I will probably give this episode 4. I can't believe I'm the only one who hasn't hooked up with somebody read stories out of 5.
That was really complicated score metric you used. I was like, wow, where is he going to go with this? That was good.
No, Reed's a complicated guy. So
Yeah, it didn't work out really well for Reed in this episode, did it?
Nope.
Reed's got to get out more. You know, he's just too reserved. So if they got to start pairing off and only 1/3 of the crew are women, I really feel he's at a disadvantage. I'm not surprised at all that Mayweather hooked up with somebody.
Well, I don't think any of the women liked pineapple.
You know, but the scene in the mess hall, it's so far removed. You know, when he tells Hoshi and Travis that, you know, the Reed line came to an unceremonious end, it was appropriate, but it was so far removed from the Reed of Shuttle Pod 1. I mean, he went from, you know, to all the girls I loved before to one is the loneliest number, you know. I think he should have spent probably more time in sick bay hanging out with Phlox than he should have in the armory by himself playing with the photon torpedoes. Just a thought. I mean, after all, Phlox hooked up with Corporal Cole. Nine kids.
All right. So, Will, how about you? Final thoughts and rating.
I really like this episode. Like I mentioned at the top of the show, it's really an episode when you think about it on paper, it really shouldn't work the way it should. The temporal mechanics doesn't really make sense. It's right in the middle of a Zindi arc. They're introducing a lot of these new characters, new concepts, and yet it really works because it's all about the characters. And that's what Star Trek's about. It's all about the characters. And, you know, Jolene really pulls double duty, and she really does it really well, both as old T'Pol and herself. David Andrew as Lorian, you know, even Archer and everyone else in the crew have some really great moments. So it works as, I like watching this episode just as a standalone, and it works in a lot of ways just because it retells a very familiar time travel story, but I think it does it in a really superb way. So I would give it, you know, 4 out of 4 old plasma injectors.
Very good. How about you, Mike?
I echo what everyone else has said. This is a great character episode. As a standalone episode, it's excellent. I've been enjoying the series Elementary lately, and one of the aspects of the Sherlock character in this particular series is his struggle with addiction. I'm really glad that we continue to develop that narrative a little bit with T'Pol in this episode. I don't know that Star Trek's ever really explored addiction in this way before. I mean, we had Barclay and his hollow addiction, but I mean, seriously, exploring the struggle with addiction, I think it's interesting. I think it does it here in a way that's very Star Trek, and I think that's good. One of the reasons I enjoy Star Trek is that it's optimistic. It paints a picture of humanity's really bright potential. And the storyline, I think, captures that in terms of T'Pol overcoming addiction. I'm glad that they left it open-ended as far as the fate of the generational ship. If we go back to Children of Time, I think the answer to the question of what happened here with the ship, you know, Jadzia sadly tells Sisko that everyone on the settlement's gone, that they never existed. And Sisko says to her, you know, they existed as long as we remember them. They, you know, they always will. So I think this is an excellent episode. My favorite line in the episode is actually the last line. Degra says, "Captain, you're early."
Yeah.
So I'm going to give this episode 4 out of 5 isomagnetic collectors.
Oh, that's a good one.
All right. All right. Mm. I think my favorite line may be when T'Pol says, "Why do we remember them?" Just because it sums up what the story was about for me, which is the characters exploring themselves and their futures. And even though we don't really get to explore the futures of Reed or Travis or Hoshi very much, they are mentioned. We're mainly exploring Trip and T'Pol and Archer a little bit. But I really like that line because it sums it up well. I love time travel stories, and although I did talk a bit about the mechanics of this one not making much sense, those things generally actually don't bother me with time travel stories, especially in one like this that is not really about the time travel itself. It's just a way of bringing these people together. I think this episode was edited quite well also. There are some cutscenes on the Blu-rays that were very wisely removed from the episode. In particular, the scene when Trip is in engineering with his son, with Lorian, and they're talking. The way that it ends in the episode, the way that conversation ends, has a lot of power to it. When Lorian says that it's kind of strange to be able to actually tell you that you were a good father, and then it ends. That conversation keeps going on and on after that in the original cut, and they're talking about T'Pol and how Trip can't see himself being together with her and so forth, and it's really superfluous, and it actually spoils the power of the father-son relationship. So that was edited very well, I think. And there's also a scene with Archer and Phlox and sickbay, which is completely cut. And yeah, I mean, it adds a little bit more to the, oh, these are our descendants and how does this affect the timeline and such. But I think it's good that it's gone. There is one comment that Phlox makes in there, though, which I think is a cute nod to the next generation when Phlox tells Archer that maybe one of these days Starfleet will consider allowing children on a starship.
Yeah.
That was kind of nice. But I love this episode. I was watching it last night on the train on the way back. And when I finished, I just tweeted out, you know, such a great episode, because I think it really is a really good story. And I enjoy it very much as a standalone and how it ties into the third season's indie arc. So I'm going to give this episode 30 Phlox offspring.
Woo. Out of a potential of many, many more, because apparently
a potential of 10,
really just
a potential, you know, of thousands.
Pump, yes, them out.
Phlox was really restraining himself, actually.
Oh man,
to limit it to that. Just 9 children with Amanda, and then of course 30 descendants. So
I just loved how the genes, how the Denobulan genes were so strong.
They were, right. I mean, those children, like a pure Denobulan.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay, well, before we go, thank you so much for joining us, Mike and Will. We'll take a moment and tell everyone where else they can find you around the interwebs and on the network.
Sure, you can always find me on Twitter. I actually have a new Twitter handle just for Trek FM. It's at Boomer Niner, which is
Boomer Niner,
pretty apt because I'm a huge Boomer. I'm a huge Niner fan. So together, it's like Voltron, right? And I'll form the head, right? Of just, you know, my different Trek fandoms forming together. So you can find me at Boomer Niner.
Boomer Niner!
You'll always find me in... It works so well.
It's our new thing, Will. Sorry.
Just like Star Trek Beyond.
I can see a t-shirt now with just giant Boomer Niner with 3 exclamation marks on the front.
This is happening.
I'm totally digging it. And you can find me in the Babel Conference, which is our dedicated Facebook listeners group. It's a really great conversation. It's a really great community to have all types of geek conversations about Star Trek and non-Star Trek. And I'm also the content manager for the network. So if you have any ideas on topics or issues we haven't talked about, feel free to drop me a line. And of course, I'm the co-host of Warp 5 with Norm, where we talk everything Enterprise.
Awesome. All right, Mike, how about you?
Again, thank you so much. It's been a delight to join you guys here on the Ready Room. I'm most active on Facebook. You can find me somewhat frequently in the Babel Conference. You can also find me on Twitter. My username is at cmichael1701. I'm a proud supporter of Trek FM, associate producer for Warp 5. I'm a boomer.
Boomer. I didn't yell it this time. All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
No, well, Chris, that was an absolutely fabulous episode talking about E2 with pretty much almost all of the Warp 5 crew, including you.
Yeah, old-time Warp 5.
Old-time Warp 5 crew, because it was about old-time Enterprise crew, new-time Enterprise crew, so it was very apropos.
It really was, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad we chose this episode, because I had not watched this one in, it might be about a year. You know, I've done a couple of full Enterprise rewatches over the past few years. I think I've watched it straight through at least twice because when we were developing Warp 5, of course, I did a full rewatch then.
Yeah.
And I've done one since. But still, it's as far as Star Trek episodes go, I've seen each episode of Enterprise the least probably of the other series just because I've had fewer years to watch them.
Sure.
So it was really fun seeing this one again and watching how it relates to past Star Trek time travel stories, and great having Mike and Will on with us as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's such a treat to be able to have newer voices on the show. I mean, Will's been on the Ready Room for a few episodes, but I believe Mike said that this was his first time
this
here
was his
on the
first,
Ready Room.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's a great thing for Mike because, you know, he's involved in the behind the scenes of the network and he's an associate producer for Warp 5. And he actually got a chance to come on the flagship show and talk about an episode of Enterprise. So for an Enterprise fan, for someone who supports Warp 5, that is a trifecta, I do believe.
It is. It's a hat trick.
It is a hat trick. Yes.
I guess. I don't know. Get my analogies mixed up here. But so, yeah. So as we mentioned during the show, Mike is an associate producer of Warp 5, and a lot of our associate producers become very involved in the network and even sometimes end up hosting shows and such. So Norm, tell everyone how people become associate producers.
Well, we have a fantastic program here to help support the network, and that program is called Patreon. And just to give you a little bit of my own personal experience, and this is probably the same way that Mike and Floyd Dorsey, who is also an associate producer of Warp 5, help the network and help the show that they like listening to most and want to support. So the Patreon program has a variety of different milestones that you can use to support Trek FM. We are a funded network funded by the fans, and we are independently run so that we have our own operating costs and overhead. And the funding from Patreon helps us with those costs. And at certain levels, at certain monetary milestones, you too can choose to support a show of your choosing and to eventually possibly even become part of the conversation on air as Mike just did. So please take a look at patreon.com/trekfm and see if there is a fit for you there. It's not obligatory by any means, but however you would like to support us through that program, please take a look, see what works best for you. And that's a way that you can help add your voice to this network.
Yeah. And especially for the Ready Room, I want to thank our associate producers on this show in particular. And that's Renee Roberts and Zachary Frueling. And you can find Renee on Twitter. Her username is Maris_1701. Renee is a huge supporter of the network going all the way back from when I very first started the network. She has been there with me all the way through, long before we had things like Patreon as ways to support the network. And I just really, really appreciate everything Renee has done for us over the years. And also Zachary Frueling, who you've heard here on the Ready Room a number of times recently. And you can find him on Twitter. That is his handle on Twitter, Zachary Frueling. That's Fruhling. And we really thank both Renee and Zachary for everything they do for the Ready Room. And anyone at an associate producer level is involved in the patrons roundtables, which you may have heard, because those are in the master feed and on SoundCloud and such. And that's a chance to have discussions like we had in the Ready Room today. But also, you know, for us, you know, Norm is an executive producer of the network here. And of course, I'm the publisher. For us, you know, when people come in and they donate that way and they say, you know, I want to be an associate producer, more than the money, it's also a signal that they really love the network and they really want to be part of what we're doing. And so that's a great way for us to know, like, here's somebody who can really be a good part of our team. And that's how we expand our crew as well. So do go check it out. We really appreciate all the support that everyone gives us, everyone who's listening, everyone who supports us through Patreon. And the URL for that is patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And all the information that you need is there on the page. But if you have questions, you know, feel free to contact us through the form, trek.fm/contact, and let us know what questions you have. Or we can also answer questions in the Babel Conference, on Twitter, or wherever. So if you want to share your thoughts on the show today, those are the contact places as well. Again, the username at trek.fm on Twitter, trek.fm/contact. There's a form there for all the different shows. The Babel Conference is the place. Norm, if people want to find you personally, where should they go?
Well, you can always find me on Twitter at Norman Lau. That's N-O-R-M-A-N-L-A-O. And then I'm always posting on the Babel Conference, our Facebook dedicated listeners page. We've mentioned that several times here on the show. You can always find me on the Axanar fan group page on Facebook. That is Alec Peters' project for a continuation of the original series prior to Kirk. And you can see that on Facebook as well. And I'm an executive producer of Trek FM, as Chris mentioned, and I am always supporting the network through Patreon, because that's how I was able to add my voice to this discussion, and definitely is worth your time to at least take a look and see how you can help grow this network, because this is a fantastic network. I've met so many great people here. I've had the opportunity to share my fandom with a lot of new friends, and if you're a Star Trek fan, you owe it to yourselves just to continue the conversation.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
So I've pretty much told you pretty everywhere you can find me on Trek FM. So Chris, more importantly, where can our fans find you, the head of this network?
Okay. Well, I don't know if that's more important or not, except if it relates to the Ready Room, since this is actually my show. And
this is your show.
I'm the only permanent host on this show. So yeah, you would want to contact me if it's about the Ready Room. You can find me on Twitter. I'm a big Twitter guy. My username there is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's also my username on Facebook. That's actually my username everywhere in social media. So C. Brian Jones. I'm very consistent everywhere. You can find me in the Babel Conference, of course. I love chatting there as I have time to do that. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing. We talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine on that show. I also do Hyperchannel from time to time. That's a short news show. It's usually just me. And I do Continuing Mission occasionally as well. That's our show about fan films. It's been kind of on a hiatus since my job changed back at the end of last year. But we've done a few episodes. Eric Brazier has done one as well. And we're working on getting that going again a little bit more. If you want to read my writing about Star Trek, you can find that on the official website at StarTrek.com. I have a column there called Trekspectives. There should be a new one out pretty soon. I put out a new column roughly about once a month there on the site. And then if you want to go beyond, I was really, really calm there, the world of Star Trek, and you want to just hear me talk about other things, I do another podcast that has nothing to do with Star Trek called Metropolis On Air. That is tied to the magazine that I run here in Tokyo, which is called Metropolis. And on there, I do interviews, but they're on a wide range of topics. And then we also do other little chat segments. We have Japanese language tips and things about life in Tokyo. And we just do a lot of fun stuff on there. And you can find that in iTunes and other places by searching Metropolis On Air, or go to metropolisjapan.com and you should see it there on the front page. But if you don't, just search for podcast and it'll come right on up.
And more importantly, most recently, you have been promoted to the rank of captain of the USS Tokyo, Captain Christopher Brian Jones.
That's right. So you can just send a subspace message to the USS Tokyo and I'll take that there in my Ready Room. Thanks for that, James Swallow. All right, Norm. I think that's everything that we have for the show today. It's another long Ready Room, but hey, the Ready Room's always been long. but I'm going to go and head on back down to the mess hall because I just want to watch Reed try to pick up women. Because now that he knows that he ended up alone, I know he's not going to let that happen in this new repaired timeline. I don't know if it's repaired or not, but he's going to make sure he gets him a woman.
If there's one thing that actually stands the test of time, it is Malcolm Reed's social awkwardness.
This is true.
Maybe he needs like a pineapple whip or perhaps something of the dole variety.
That sounds painful. I picture like a pineapple whip having like smoothie spikes on it.
Pineapple smoothie.
Oh, okay. Sorry. When anyone says whip here, I just think about The Last Outpost and variations on the Ferengi electric whip.
It's a problem with the universal translator. I blame Hoshi. So as Chris goes off to see what's happening with Malcolm, I'm going to basically sit here for 111 years and wait for myself to come back and give myself a fork so I can stick it in it because the ready room is done.